This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we mourn the loss of our longtime friend and colleague, Lynn Stewart.
She passed away on March 7th on the eve of International Women's Day. Lynn Stewart was truly a hero.
We also remember our own Michael Ratner, and in a tribute to the Center for Constitutional Rights at Berlin at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, our own Michael Smith, joined by Margaret Ratner Kunstler, deliver personal remarks.
Margaret and I spoke to a group of around 100 young attorneys from all over the world, the majority of them young women attorney fighters for human rights, on the legacy of Michael Ratner and on the history and the founding of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, we mourn the loss today of our friend and comrade Lynn Stewart, who died yesterday, March 7th, at her home in Brooklyn, New York. She was persecuted and imprisoned by the government in an attempt to silence dissent, to curtail vigorous defense by lawyers, and to instill fear in those who would seek to help Arabs and Muslims.
Michael, this was a highly unusual prosecution. It actually came on the heels of surveillance of Lynn Stewart. She'd been wiretapped. And the unusual aspect, or one of the unusual aspects, was that then-Attorney General John Ashcroft actually traveled to New York City to appear on the David Letterman show to announce the arrest of Lynn. I don't recall any time this has ever been so brought into popular culture on a relatively comedic show. And I think it was indeed to let the general public know that advocating on behalf of what some would call controversial clients was not going to be tolerated by the government.
Yeah, totally unethical. It's impermissible to color a potential juror by going on national television like he did. In any case, it led to the trial. And Lynn, well, let's back up, because Lynn had started off not as a lawyer, but as a teacher. And then she became a librarian up in Harlem. That's where she met Ralph Pointer, her husband and comrade for all these years. She was known as an attorney that represented the poor, the despised, the cast out. And she would represent people, and then she'd visit them in prison. She'd befriended them when they came out. She remembered their birthdays, and she sent them notes on Christmas. She was the kind of attorney that would really do anything for her clients.
Listeners may remember, sorry to interrupt, Michael, but she represented Larry Davis in the mid-90s. He was in a surprise acquittal. He'd been charged with trying to kill 9 police officers in a Bronx shootout, and they argued self-defense, and they won.
Yeah, they said that cops were trying to assassinate Larry Davis. She and Bill Kunstler did the trial. It was amazing, and they won. And that's really when she came to the attention of the general public. So when the Sheikh was put on trial, Lynn was one of the attorneys, Ramsey Clark was another, and Abdin Jabara was the paralegal. The Sheikh initially had wanted Bill Kunstler, and he was willing to do the trial, but the judges who appoint the people on the panel that defend people accused of criminal activity in federal courts, there's a panel, and Bill Kunstler was adjudged to be not competent to represent. He was one of the great attorneys in American history, and then they said he wasn't capable of representing the Sheikh. So the trial might have been different because of the publicity would have been generated by Bill. But in any case, he was knocked out, and Ramsey and Lynn represented him. The Sheikh was accused of conspiracy of supporting terrorism, and story didn't come out about what really happened. And what really happened was the government was eager to put the Sheikh behind bars. The Sheikh was a fiery cleric in New Jersey, and the government sent...
And a high-profile leader.
Yes. The government sent agents to try to entrap him into a crime. And they approached him, and they said, "We're going to blow up the World Trade Center. why don't you do it? And he said, no. They said, well, we'd like you to help us. We're going to blow up the Lincoln Tunnel. He said, no. They came back and they said, what about the Holland Tunnel? And the sheikh, trying to get rid of these people, said, why don't you pick a military target? So they got him. They got him for seditious conspiracy, trying to overthrow the American government because of the military trial throwaway line that he did. They put him on trial, and they convicted him. He was in prison. Lynn Stewart visited him in her effort to keep his name before the public. After the visit, she issued a press release to Reuters, and the press release said that the sheikh was considering the position of his group back in Egypt about the ceasefire that they had gone into with the Egyptian government. And the sheikh said, look, I'm in jail here in the United States. I don't know what's going on. I leave it up to you. So they got Lynn Stewart for releasing this press release saying that this was a material support of terrorism and part of a conspiracy, and that's what they tried her on.
The only way that Lynn was allowed into prison to visit the sheikh was if she would sign what's called a special administrative measure, or a SAM. And this took up a lot of time in the courtroom because people who believe her sentence was too harsh, as we do, would argue that what she did was merely an administrative violation by issuing and engaging in what we think was zealous advocacy. She wanted to keep his name sort of alive and in the public by issuing this press release. But technically, that was just a violation of this administrative order.
No one had ever gone to jail.
Exactly.
For that.
In fact, this had happened, remember, under the Clinton administration when Janet Reno was Attorney General. They knew about this, and all they said to Lynn was, just don't do this again.
Yeah, it was a slap on the wrist offense.
Yeah, but I think our listeners should know that the Clinton administration was aware of it. She got a slap on the wrist, but then come in Bush and Ashcroft, and they make, no pun intended, a federal case out of it.
Really, they wanted to make an example of her and scare
case.
The other attorneys.
Exactly.
Exactly. Heidi, you and I were at the trial. Talk about it, will you?
Well, Michael, it was Michael Tigar, who's been a guest on our show, was her lead counsel. And later other people, Josh Dreitel, Liz Fink, would also be part of representing her in different phases. Michael Tigar, noted litigator. It was an uphill battle that was destined to fail because here we are at 500 Pearl Street in the federal courtroom that is literally just blocks away from the former site of the World Trade Center. And introduced by the prosecution are inflammatory photos of violence, both in Egypt and in different parts, references to Osama bin Laden, everything that a judge would usually rule as too prejudicial. Its prejudicial effect outweighs any probative value. So,
and the judge gave an exclusionary order. He'd say, they'd show photographs of bombing in Egypt, and they'd say, this doesn't relate to Lynn Stewart, so you should ignore it.
Right.
How do you ignore it?
Right. The defense gave it their all, but in a climate in which the government really has everyone afraid of another terrorist attack on New York or U.S. soil, she was really doomed.
Doomed. They bust the jurors in and this armed bus, you know. So the jurors were scared to death even about being down there.
Right.
So what? Well, she got 28 months.
So she got 28 months. And we must remind people that I think part of the reason was her vast body of really humanitarian, selfless work on behalf of the, you know, Larry Davis and so many other clients, including David Gilbert. The defense got hundreds of letters from people that made an enormous impact on the judge. He cited that in his 28-month sentencing. But Michael, as you know, after that, an appeals court upheld the verdict, but it directed Judge Codal to re-examine his 28-month sentence.
You know why? Remember when Lynn was on Amy Goodman's show?
Yes.
And Amy asked her the following question, would you do it again?
Yeah.
And she said yes.
Yeah.
And that incensed the appellate court.
Right.
Judge Walker on the appellate court, who was George Bush's cousin, directed Judge Codal at the court below to revise the sentence. And we were in the courthouse that
day. Yes. Yeah.
I remember when Judge Codal said, I'm upping the sentence from 28 months to 10 years, and there was a gasp. And Lynn's young daughter, Zenobia, just gasped. And Lynn's attorney rose and asked the judge, "Why did you do this?" Mm-hmm. And the judge said, "I was directed to."
And compounding that tragedy was the fact that Lynn was very ill with breast cancer.
But they sent her to a federal prison in Texas. She asked to be in a prison somewhere near New York so that her friends and relatives could visit her. They sent her cruelly to a prison in Texas. She spent 4 years there, but she got out.
She got out in early 2014 after many requests for compassionate release, given the state of her health, were sent. And I believe it took a while to have that happen, but she finally returned to her family and home in New York.
She had stage 4 breast cancer.
Yeah.
She was only supposed to live for a max of 18 months.
Right. Yes, she lived for almost 3 more years.
You know, Lynn Wineglass gave an assessment of the situation. This is years ago. And I want to read it, Heidi, because I think it shows how accurate Lynn saw things as they would unfold. Lynn said of her incarceration, quote, the Lynn Stewart case is the case that's going to mark this era as the era of the war on terror, which includes the war on lawyers who defend those who are accused of terrorism. To put her behind bars when no one was injured, no one was harmed, when those who produced the torture memos, those who produced the war are going free and even prospering is really the irony of our times.
Well said, Michael. We've had Lynn on Law and Disorder several times. In memory of her, we're going to play an excerpt from a previous show.
Let's take a listen.
Lynn is like the poster child for claiming that lawyers who defend alleged terrorists are terrorists themselves. Lynn is a poster child for trying to intimidate lawyers from taking on tough, difficult cases. Lynn has struggled mightily as of her supporters to make sure that's not the message the government sends to all of us. So we're really excited today to have Lynn Stewart with us to talk about her reaction to the recent argument in the Court of Appeals.
Lynn, welcome back once again to Law and Disorder.
My favorite show. Thank you for letting me be here.
What an endorsement. It's great, Lynn.
Well, Lynn, you've been our colleague and our friend and our comrade over the years. We're here to talk about the January 28th appellate oral argument in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals here in New York City. We're very happy to have you on the show. We want to go over with our audience what was said back on that Tuesday in the appellate court.
We're all familiar with the case, and we assume our listeners are, but just in case, let's just do a brief review. In 2002, Ashcroft announced an indictment against you, Lynn.
Right, for a press release that I had made to Reuters in 2000.
The Reno administration.
During the Reno administration, indeed. Pat Fitzgerald, the later of Valerie Plame fame.
Prosecutor.
Whatever way you want to look at that. Yes, the prosecutor. He was the head of the anti-terrorism in the Southern District at that point, and he's the one who called me and told me that I had violated a set of prison regulations known as SAMs by virtue of speaking to the media on behalf of my client. Within, I would say, 6 months, the whole matter was basically forgotten. I had re-signed the SAMs. I'd gone in to see my client again. It was resurrected with the war on terror. After 911, they needed bodies. They needed people to say.
Let me go back for a second. So the time when Fitzgerald called you and said, Lynn, you violated SAMs, was what year?
August 2000.
So that was under the Clinton administration.
Under the Clinton administration.
And violating a SAMS, let's be perfectly clear, is not a criminal offense.
It's not it's interesting because people seem to think it's a court order or a crime. Actually, it, as I said, it's a Bureau of Prison Regulation that they put into against the client, and the lawyer merely signs on that they're aware of them. I don't want to minimize it, but I would say within the body of these rules and regulations, regulations, it said if you break these, you may be denied the right to visit your client, just like so many prison regulations. Except in my case, they waited for 2 years and then they indicted. And they didn't just indict, they said that it was materially aiding a terrorist organization.
Now, when they say they waited, we had a change in administrations.
Yes.
And we had 9/11, and then the current, the Bush administration and Ashcroft, who was Attorney General, decided to look back at what had happened 2 years before.
Right. Well, they wanted to make an example out of it, and they wanted to scare lawyers. So Ashcroft flies into New York. He gets on the David Letterman show, and he announces on the David Letterman show that they've got this red-hot lawyer terrorist. You know, what they had was a 64-year-old grandmother, but they portrayed you as the devil. And when you dehumanize somebody like that, as we know, they're able to victimize them. So they tried you in Lower Manhattan. They had a few blocks
away from the World Trade Center.
Right near the hole. They had a jury, an anonymous jury, that was escorted back and forth from their homes in a police van. They showed, I was at the trial, they had 20-foot-high videos of Osama bin Laden.
This is after the jury had been promised by the judge during the early questioning that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with this, because some of the jurors said, it's Osama bin Laden. If he's in the case, I might have a problem with this. And then he said, oh, no, he's not in the case. He's got nothing to do with it. And yet he did allow the government pretty much out of the box to use these pictures, this videotape that was found in the basement of my co-defendant.
Yeah, and let's also say that they put you on trial with a translator, and they also put you on trial with another fellow who was a practicing Muslim and had ties with people in Egypt and so on, and he was doing stuff that you don't even know about. But in any case, they made an amalgam. They grouped you. They should have severed the trial, but they didn't, and they put you with other people, which made it much harder for you to defend yourself. They put on, what was it, an 8-month trial, something like 17,000 pages of transcript.
Right. I would also say that one of the most remarkable things at the trial, connection with the Osama bin Laden and in connection with other pieces of evidence, the judge instructed the jury 750 times that they were to disregard this evidence as to Lynn Stewart. This was only introduced as to Mr. Sitar, the third party that you mentioned, and that it was not offered for the truth in any case, but merely as to Mr. Sitar's state of mind. So here we have Osama parading at 10 times life size across the courtroom on the individualized TV sets, and the judge telling them, ignore this. Ignore this.
So
750 times.
Well, the jury was out for a while, right?
They were out for about a week. You know, what we know is there was some coercion. One of the black jurors came back a month after deliberations saying that she feared for her life in that jury room and felt she had to convict. But the judge basically brushed that aside. He said she could have come to me at any time. Not exactly true. And I was convicted.
What were you convicted of?
I was convicted of materially aiding a terrorist organization and conspiracy to materially aid.
And what was that? What kind of aid did you give them?
Well, if you want to stretch this little thing out, it's the theories of the government, and I appreciate you're making the distinction between the Clinton government, and I don't see all that much distinction, but I must say this Machiavellian government is beyond all belief. But their theory was that I provided aid to the IG, which is one of the listed terrorist organizations in Egyptian.
The Islamic group.
The Islamic group in Egypt. By virtue of the fact that I brought the words of my client, I provided personnel by virtue of the words of the sheikh in the press release. That was their theory. That's the materially aiding. You know, this is a law that has been under attack. The judge in my case dismissed the first indictment because he said no lawyer could know what the heck they were supposed to do.
And we should make clear that then the government came back with a superseding indictment,
yes,
essentially changing, was it the definition of material support?
No, they brought it under a different section of the law. And this section of the law speaks in terms of knowledge and intent, an added thing. And the judge initially had said to us he intended to charge knowledge and intent. Unfortunately, when we got down to the charge, he charged knowledge. but he didn't charge intent.
So they convicted you of having knowledge of providing these words, this press release. And what did the press release say?
Well, it was more than that, Michael. I mean, their contention is I knew who the sheikh was. I had represented him from 1994. Yusri knew who the sheikh was. He was the subject of his PhD thesis. Therefore, knowing who he was and making the press release indicated that we had knowledge that this was a terrorist and this was going to a terrorist organization.
What did the press release say?
Well, the press release, this is one of the great bones of contention here. The press release said from the sheikh, personally, I no longer support a ceasefire that we unilaterally entered into. That was the first press release. And I can only say to you that it caused a tremendous furore because, of course, the IG was not expecting this and they didn't know how to cope with it. But it got a lot of press in the Middle East, got no press here whatsoever. But in the Middle East, it caused a large furore. And then we were asked to clarify it, at which point the sheikh said again, I'm not telling you to end the ceasefire. I am only saying to you that it does not appear from my vantage point in the middle of Minnesota to be working. He's hearing about people being killed ex-officially. He's hearing about arrests, the tortures in the jail, for which Egypt is famous. And he said it doesn't appear to be working, so let's raise up the media attention and go forward. But this is for you to decide. You're there on the ground. I don't think he said on the ground. That's a real Bushism. But anyway, and they got this message. Now, the government wanted to say this was a directive from the chief of the IG to resume armed struggle, to start killing people again.
But in fact, the ceasefire never was lifted and nobody was hurt, were they?
Exactly.
But they want to send this now 67-year-old grandmother.
Eight.
Happy birthday to prison for 30 years. And that's what it was all about when we were in the appellate court.
So it was about the sentencing that the judge imposed. And the government's argue is that you should get 30 years rather than the 2 years and 4 months that he gave you.
Right.
Russ, back at the district court, the government, as was said, asked for 30 years. And the judge, after getting 1,000 letters in your support, after talking about what you've done in the bar, how you represent people with no money, everybody in your community. I've always been amazed by that when I go to your talks. There's 1,000 people you've represented on everything from landlord-tenant to, like, small claims court to major felonies. I mean, you're a major community and city and country resource, and I think the judge recognized that. He actually said that.
Yes.
And he basically gave you this 28-month sentence, right, which means you would do based on parole, you do...
Probably. There's no parole in feds anymore, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever way you see the parole system. But it's about a 20-month sentence, maybe. It probably is unlikely I could get into a halfway house because of the nature of what I'm convicted of.
But so the government was not happy.
Oh, they were very, very. That day in court, we all can agree that they were.
And when did that sentence come down? What was that?
That was October 2006.
So it's over a year ago that sentence. So then there's an appeal. There's an appeal by the government saying the sentence is
too short,
and there's an appeal by you saying I was wrongfully convicted.
I will say wrongfully convicted, and it was. And you're familiar with briefs in the Second Circuit. They usually, if you send in a 101-page brief, they send it back to you. But this, we put in a 500-page brief.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And in a nutshell, what did you argue about your wrongful conviction?
Well,
500-page brief. I'm going to use it for pressing leaves.
Well, one of the judges said, we're well aware of the weight of your arguments that they held up these massive
Did they really?
Books. Yes.
Judge
Sachs said, I think Mr. Dreitel, my lawyer, I think every case in the English language you cited in your brief, so don't worry about it. We'll find it. But at any rate, there were a million issues, as you know. There's a whole free speech issue. There's an issue of stretching the law. There's an issue of selective prosecution. My dear friend Bramsey did the same exact things I did. There's the issue of FISA and NSA wiretaps. We don't even know what happened there. We only know the judge decided against us when we raised it, but there were classified documents involved. I mean, there are a myriad of issues. But what we focused on yesterday was the intent and the knowledge issue. First Amendment.
The idea because that you would need intent and knowledge to have materially aided a terrorist group.
Right, exactly. You had to have both. That was right. That's our contention.
Knowledge wouldn't be enough.
Right, and that never did I have an intent.
Right.
Never, never, never. Right. My intent was to serve my client,
right.
not to serve his cause.
And so, what is the First Amendment argument that Josh Dratel raised about?
It's the fundamental love of the First Amendment lawyers, and that is that, yes, this is a maybe reprehensible speech in some people's minds, but it is not Portell imminent danger. It is nowhere near the standard set in Brandenburg or in, I'm forgetting, something hardware store, which was a black boycott of a hardware in Mississippi, because it was a step away, and because nothing ever happened, you hardly could say, and that this was the Sheikh's speech and my speech, and it was due protections. It's where these three things come together, intent, knowledge, and the First Amendment consideration, I think that was giving the judges a lot of difficulty yesterday.
And Lynn, jumping over to the sentencing part,
yeah,
why do you think Judge Walker was so intent trying to, seem to me, restore that 30-year sentence to make an example out of you?
The judge happens to be a first cousin of George Bush, which doesn't, we don't believe in bills of attainder. We're not saying he's guilty by reason of that. But he was right out of the first starting gate, the first questions he asked, he was making speeches about terrorism and Luxor and 70 people being killed. I mean, it's a very familiar government tactic to anybody that's done terrorism cases. They make a great promulgation of the fear of terrorism, even if it has nothing to do with what we're talking
Luxor,
about.
Luxor, of course, is a big tourist site in Egypt where a number of American and other tourists were killed.
Were killed in 1977, right. Long before this case.
And, of course, upper middle class and middle class people visit Luxor, so yes, I'm sure Judge Walker was very concerned by this.
Yes, and he knew that it would resonate,
right.
Absolutely, and this is part of what we see from this administration all the time.
Well, you know what? When you get back, we're going to call you up and see what's going on. We're going to keep track of everything that happens to you, Lynn. And we're here expressing on behalf of our entire audience our solidarity with you, our support, our love, and good luck on this decision.
Thank you so much.
I'm certainly confident on a good part of this decision.
Yeah, I'm feeling that I'm going to, as I have from day one, hope for the best and be ready, understanding politically where the country is at, be able to deal with the worst.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Michael Ratner co-founded Law and Disorder Radio 13 years ago. He died in May 2016 in New York City of complications following cancer surgery at age 73. At the time, he was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Some years ago, he helped form its European counterpart, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. Last year marked the 50th anniversary of the founding of CCR. The European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights held a commemorative conference in Berlin last December on that 50th anniversary and honored CCR's president, Michael Ratner. Our own Michael Smith spoke at the conference about Michael Ratner and the four founders of the center. He was joined in his presentation by attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, a key figure in the early days of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Today we are pleased to bring you excerpts from this presentation. Let's take a listen.
Well, thank you, Tony, and thank you, Wolfgang, and thank you, Claire. Claire designed this program and gave us our assignment, which is I'm supposed to introduce Margaret. She's going to introduce me, and then we're supposed to have a conversation about the early days of the CCR and also about Michael Ratner. We're going to talk for about a half hour. I should tell you that this conversation is totally unrehearsed, so it's going to be new to us as well as to you. Margaret Ratner Kunstler dropped out of graduate school in art history to attend Columbia Law School in the 1960s. She's a criminal defense lawyer in New York City. She currently represents Sarah Harrison and WikiLeaks. Margaret met Michael Ratner at Columbia and participated in the great student uprising there in 1968 against the racist expansion of the university, which was encroaching on Black Harlem, and also against the complicity of the university in the imperialist war in Vietnam. She worked with Michael on cases and projects from then on. She worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights for 10 years in the 70s and the 80s. And it was there that she met and worked with one of the center's founders, Bill Kunstler. She headed up the CCR's work as an education director. And then in 1983, she and Michael started the Movement Support Network, which supported individuals and organizations opposing U.S. imperialism in Central America and interference in Cuba. And later she worked on the El Salvador and Nicaraguan cases. I could say more, but I don't want to embarrass her. Let me just turn it over to her to embarrass me, and then we're going to start our discussion.
Michael Smith is a New York City attorney and author. He was on the board of the CCR for 9 years when Michael was its president. He was a dear friend of Michael's and collaborated with him on 5 books, including the recently republished How the CIA Killed Che Guevara. He founded and co-hosted with Michael the nationally broadcast current radio show Law and Disorder.
And you can get that show at lawanddisorder.org. Tony, I was going to write that down for you, and I promise I still will. What I thought we could do is start off. I first wanted to give thumbnail sketches of the 4 founders of the CCR and then ask Margaret to talk about the CCR's philosophy and politics. The CCR was founded in 1966 by 4 men, 3 Jews and a Christian. Ben Smith was the Christian. He had an office in New Orleans, which was convenient. He was the only lawyer in the whole state of Louisiana that would take a civil rights case. And New Orleans was the seat of the Fifth Circuit, which had 3 federal judges who, amazingly, were sympathetic to the civil rights movement. So the 3 New York Jews had a contact down south. Ben Smith had grown up poor in northern Louisiana, so poor that he actually went hunting and fishing to feed the family. When he was a young boy, he toured around the northern part of the state with his father. His father's job was collecting debts from poor black people. Ben was very moved by the conditions he saw while going around with his father. He put himself through college. He was a brilliant man, really a polymath. He was a good mathematician, a good navigator, in New Orleans. And he put himself through college and then went to Tulane Law School, which was the elite law school in the South. And he opened up a practice in New Orleans. Ben went up to Detroit in 1962 and urged the National Lawyers Guild, which was soon to move its headquarters from New York to Detroit, urged them to send lawyers down south. He said, we really need help down here. And that became a project that the founders of the CCR were involved in and the National Lawyers Guild was involved in, lawyers who went south to support the civil rights movement. Morton Stavinsky, whose name was later changed to Stavis, grew up as an Orthodox Jew on the Lower East Side. He went to the City University of New York in the 30s. It's a very radical place. There were Stalinists and Trotskyists and social democrats, anarchists, conversations, actions, all sorts of activity at CCNY. He got radicalized there and shed his orthodoxy. He was also very brilliant. He got into Columbia Law School. In those days, racism in the United States wasn't just directed at black people. It was also directed at Jews in the form of anti-Semitism. And Jews couldn't get into the white shoe law firms. That's what we call the fancy elite law firms. They couldn't get into the main corporations like IBM. That's why Michael and Bruce's father started his own business, and my father started his own business. So Stavis, who couldn't get a job in a white shoe law firm, got a job working for the government in D.C., and when he got down there, Robert Wagner, who was a senator from New York, had just written the Wagner Act, which set up the National Relations Labor Act, which for the first time allowed unions to form legally. And Stavis came to the attention of Wagner. At age 23, Wagner hired him to be one of his top staff people. And then he jumped ship from the Wagner staff to the United Electrical Workers Union. The UE was a radical union. It was led by members of the Communist Party or people sympathetic to the Communist Party. And he moved to Newark. And in Newark, he was hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee for having left-wing sympathies. His son reports that at that time, his babysitter weighed 350 pounds. He needed a bodyguard. Stavis was the one that incorporated the CCR in Newark in 1966, originally as the Law Center for Constitutional Rights. A few years later, the law part was dropped and it became the CCR. Why did they incorporate it? Well, Bill Kunstler and Arthur Conoy and Morton Stavis and Ben Smith had been working in the South. They were talking to each other almost every day. And they thought, well, we should just institutionalize this relationship. And secondly, they thought if they set up a not-for-profit, then people could give them money and get a tax write-off. So Morty incorporated the CCR in Newark in 66, and right away they got $40,000 from a radical lawyer in New York called Bob Bohm. And they were off to the races. Within a year, they got more support. Cora Weiss, Peter Weiss's wife, had the Nehru Foundation. She gave them money. A rich Episcopal lady in New Orleans gave them money. And within a year, they had three people on their staff. Arthur Conoy, another brilliant person, got into Harvard, which was rare because in those days there were quotas in the elite schools for Jews. And he was the coxswain on the Harvard crew team. This is a very, very slight, small man, but he would boss these, you know, the Elliots and the, you know, these ruling class people who were on their crew. And then he would finish being the coxswain and hustle up to Harvard Square to pass out leaflets. Bill Kunstler said that in those days he was a little Lenin. And when he got out of Harvard, he went into the Army during World War II. When he got out of there, he went to Columbia Law School, where he was a classmate, although he knew, but he wasn't friendly with Bill Kunstler. But he went to Columbia, and then he was offered, unusually, he was offered a job with a white shoe firm. He lasted 3 months, and he too joined the staff, United Electrical Workers Union. And the last member of the quartet was Bill Kunstler. Bill had formed a practice with his brother Michael Kunstler and with Arthur Conoy. And they used to tell judges we're the new KKK. Bill was a mischievous young kid. He called himself in his autobiography, he says, I was a real pisser. He said, I was Peck's bad boy. He was a troublemaker from the beginning. Grew up in Harlem. In those days, Harlem was not just a black neighborhood, it was also a Jewish neighborhood. And Bill went to Yale. He majored in French poetry. He graduated with honors. He, too, went into the Second World War, where he received several medals. When he came out, he went to law school, and he set up a practice in the suburbs. Bill was a liberal at that time. He affiliated himself with the American Civil Liberties Union, and they asked him to go out to California. The Carol Chessman case was going on then. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was a very important case in the 50s concerning the death penalty. Chessman had killed a couple of people on Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles. And he was remorseful and regretted it. And he begged for mercy. And there was a big movement to try to get the death penalty relieved. And Bill went out there to work on that. And on the way back, the head of the ACLU said, "Will you stop off in Jackson, Mississippi? There are some freedom riders down there, and we want you to go on there and observe what's going on." You know what a freedom rider is? These were people, blacks and whites, who boarded interstate buses to desegregate public transportation. And so Bill went to Jackson, Mississippi. When these people got off the buses, they were savagely beaten. That was the routine. And that got him involved in the civil rights movement. I'm going to finish with this point. Bill represented Martin Luther King for 6 years. He represented H. Rapp Brown, the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Brown is famous for saying violence is as American as cherry pie. He represented Malcolm X's daughter. He was a brilliant courtroom lawyer and a wonderful speaker with his beautiful bass, sonorous voice. Really a wonderful man. I could go on about him because I met him when I was in law school in 1966, but I'll stop here and just say that we'll get into the various cases that they started off with in 66 were important examples of movement lawyering, and we'll talk about in the course of our discussion. Margaret, I'm going to ask you a question. What was the philosophy and politics of the CCR back when they formed in 1966?
At that point, they had, interestingly enough, faith in the law. And that was probably because the Fifth Circuit, which had four judges that were pretty interesting, and the Fifth Circuit covered Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Now, those were the states in which the freedom rides were occurring and the marches were occurring. And so every time there was a problem in a city, they would go to the courts. And they would take the cases out of the racist state courts into the federal courts. Now, that was a trick that they figured out, because representing each individual person who was arrested, either on a freedom ride or on a march, would take years. And it would take more people than they had to represent people. So what they did was they removed the cases into federal court and either got an injunction against continuing or a mandamus, the law was held unconstitutional, or whatever they did. But they were very successful in pulling the state cases out of the state courts and into to the federal courts. Unfortunately, somebody caught on to that. And eventually, those cases were narrowed down. And at first, it was only cases where the crimes were serious crimes. It became individualized, and that wonderful remedy disappeared. That remedy disappeared at the same time that the Center for Constitutional Rights was forming, interestingly enough. So all of their thoughts about only doing affirmative litigation, only doing impact litigation, only representing social justice movements kind of had to switch a bit, because now we were into the 1970s. We had the Vietnam War. We had people individually accused of terrible crimes and had to be represented separately. What did continue as impact litigation was the women's rights movement, because there the center developed through Nancy Stearns an ability to take state cases and make them federal cases, and at least even in the state cases, bring the cases, instead of bringing the cases on behalf of doctors, brought the cases on behalf of poor women who couldn't get abortions. So that was in support of a movement, and that continued. I want to read you something that came out in the early 70s about the center, which defined the philosophy. It starts off with the illusion of lawfulness, which I won't read. And it then recites government atrocities. And it says, "It is in this context that the CCR has, since its founding in 66, played a central role in advancing the goals of progressive organizations and individuals while protecting them as they engage in their struggles. Because it has been the law that has been used as a tool of repression, it can be the law that is used as an instrument of resistance. Because it has been the law that has so often given legitimacy to governmental abuse, it can be the law that is used to strip away the facade of legitimacy where it exists and deprive it where it is sought. And because it has frequently been the law that has stood as an obstacle to change, it can be the law that is employed as an agent of social progress. Aside from using the law, and really the distinction between the center and the ACLU is the center really doesn't have much respect for the law. The center looks at the law as an instrument of repression and deals with it on that pragmatic level. The other part of this that has developed and continued is the fact that the center has always been involved in social movements and continues to be involved in social movements. The staff originally was selected because they were embedded. They participated. The women's rights movement, the Puerto Rican independence movement, all of the people who were hired because, not only because they were great lawyers, but because they were devoted to various separate movements. And that kept the center on its path. And it kept it devoted to the movements that it supported. Both Michael and Bill, over and over again, they really felt that without a social justice movement supporting what was happening, nothing could happen, because they really believed that things happened in the streets, not in the courtroom. And anything that happened in the court that was successful happened because of what was happening in the street. So it was the same thing with the women's rights movement, with every movement that we have experienced. The only time that the law has been a successful tool is when there were people on the streets asking and moving for change. The law on its own is very ineffective and boring, to say the least.
Margaret, Bill didn't start out that way. He really did have a belief in the law, and I wanted to ask you about what he thought and how it changed and what caused him to change it.
Bill described the Chicago 8 trial. Now, that was a trial in Chicago. 8 people were accused of crossing state lines to cause a riot. And that was around the 68 National Convention. 8 people were indicted and accused of inciting the riots that went on. In fact, it was quite clear that it was a police riot. And it was reported as such. It wasn't a people's riot. It was a police riot that caused the whole thing. Anyway, Bill's experience during the trial made him realize that the law was not always helpful. And in fact, he could see that it was a tool of repression. And it was his Rubicon. He described it as that. And from then on, he understood the law not as an instrument of change, but as a way of preventing change. And that really radicalized him and changed his whole point of view.
Yeah. What did he say? It's an instrument of the ruling elite to perpetuate itself by any means necessary for as long as possible. That was what his understanding of the law was. He also quit the ACLU twice. The second time, remember, was when the ACLU defended the right of Nazis to demonstrate in Cleveland. And Bill said, "I represent the movement, not the Constitution." Margaret, let's come up to the work that Michael did at the center around Central America. And I wondered whether you might talk about that. And then I was going to talk about Michael's work with respect to the defense of the Cuban Revolution. But first, let's talk about Central America, because Michael got very active for about 10 years. Went down there, 30 times to Nicaragua, and was very active in promoting and hoping that those revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua wouldn't be crushed by the United States.
After Reagan was elected in 1980, he had his first cabinet meeting where he handed each cabinet member a copy of the Mandate for Leadership, which was a report created by the Heritage Foundation, which mapped out exactly what they wanted to accomplish during the Reagan years. Michael, at our first staff meeting after the election, also passed out this book, not to everybody because we didn't have the money to purchase that many, but you know, five copies went into the library, and it was Michael's advice to everybody that you'd better start reading this because this is what's going to happen. And what the Heritage Report said was, we've had too many FBI agents staying inside the FBI. Now, that was because previous to that, there was a law passed supposedly to catch mafiosa. It was an anti-mafia law. And it changed the definition of immunity. And immunity no longer was use immunity. It was the immunity only for what you said at the time. You couldn't be indicted for exactly what you said, but you could be indicted if other evidence was brought up or it was a different crime. So it changed it. So the FBI then became homebound. They only subpoenaed people to grand juries because this was a wonderful tool. You could indict people. You could put them away for lengths of time, for 18 months, even more than that, if they refused to testify. So that's what the FBI did. Well, the Heritage Foundation came out with this report saying, we've had these agents inside for too long. We have to push them out on the street. We're going to put them out on the street, and we're going to have them walk around and intimidate people. This is going to be much more effective. And we're going to start getting rid of these radicals in Central America. That's the other thing we're going to do. I mean, they had a whole list of what they were going to accomplish. They were going to invest more money in arms. And all of these things did, in fact, happen. It was a remarkable coup on their part. Michael, having read this report and having a discussion in the group, understood that what we had to do was to immediately begin to protect the movement against these things that were going to happen. Because we didn't know that it was going to happen, but we were thinking, okay, what are we going to do if this happens? And Michael was, you know, the way Michael was so powerful and so brilliant was he knew what was happening. He was conscious of it, and he prepared everybody for it. He knew what was happening before it happened, and he set up ways of dealing with it. So he figured out strategies for litigation, and he had the idea for the Movement Support Network. The Movement Support Network was to function to protect the movement.
I did want to talk about the Central Park jogger case, Yusuf Salaam, the fact that Bill Kunstler took that case to the center refused to take it, what we learned from that, and how Michael got the center involved in the challenge to executive authority, all the litigation that's been going on since 9/11. So, Margaret, would you tell that story? You know, the Central Park joggers were falsely accused. They were children, and they were falsely accused of raping and beating a white woman jogger in Central Park. And the press was scandalously ferocious against them. Our friend Donald Trump famously offered a $100,000 reward and wanted to give them the death penalty. That was the atmosphere in New York with respect to the Central Park joggers and Yusuf Salaam. And that's Bill was not representing Yusuf at the trial, but he came in on it at the sentencing part. And at that point, Margaret's going to take over and tell the story about what happened and then how the center later on got involved in the stuff after 9/11.
Bill became involved in the jogger case on the appeal level, and the resentencing level. When Bill took the case to the center, it was refused. It was refused because the concept was that the center was, you know, very famous with their women's rights litigation, and how could they possibly justify representing rapists? Accused rapists and convicted rapists, and it just would interfere with their funding. It just would not be healthy for the organization, and they refused to take the case. In 2011, when the first military act was promulgated, Michael looked at it and he said, "The center has got to get active here. These people are defined as the worst people on earth. We're going to have roundups. We don't even know what's going to happen. and the center has to be prepared to deal with it. The center has to acknowledge that they're going to represent all of these people who are rounded up, all of these people who are thrown into Guantanamo. We didn't know at that point exactly where they would be thrown, but they were pretty soon taken to Guantanamo. So Michael went to the board meeting, to the staff meeting, and he said, you know, I'm going to recommend this, and I know it's a very hard thing now because New York City has had a terrible experience. We've all been very close to it. We've all probably lost friends there or, you know, been some way affected by this terrible thing that's happened to the World Trade Center. But we have to step back from this. We have to learn from our past. We have to learn from what we did. And he went into the meeting and he read from Bill's autobiography about how the center had refused the Jogger cases and explained to them, you know, sometimes you have to overcome what your first reaction is and understand the political importance of what you might accomplish here. And the center then agreed, despite overwhelming thoughts that they were going to lose their funding, that they were going to get hate mail. And all of these things did happen for a while. There's no question that that was a result. But Michael explained to people that that's what they had to do. And Michael went on to explain, my daughters did a film about their father a few years after he died. And in that film, Michael explained in their interview of him that he had come to understand why Bill had represented all of these people who people said, how can Bill be representing the first World Trade Center bombings? How can he be representing all of these people, these Arabs accused of crimes? I mean, how is it possible? And Michael said to them, he understood at that point in time that it was so important to stand up and be bold enough to represent the people who were called the worst of the worst. Because if you didn't do that, then you had no ability to function in society after that, because it would all be over at that point.
That was an excerpt from a presentation by our own Michael Smith, along with Margaret Ratner Kunstler, at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin. The event was marking the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and it was also a tribute to Michael Ratner.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.